Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 30. The Rising Tide. From this point onwards, the tide of Mrs. Eddy's teaching rises steadily. There is to be much ebbing and flowing. There are to be times when the wash backwards is so extreme as to give the impression of almost complete reversal. But viewed over the months and years, the move forward is steady and emphatic. Something happened at Barton, almost, if not quite, as important as that which had supervened upon the little disaster at Lynn 16 years before. It may be venturing too far into the realm of interference to say that at Lynn, Mrs. Eddy discovered to her satisfaction the allness of God, and at Barton, the nothingness of evil. Yet it is a fact that from the time she returned to Boston from Barton, she moved forward with more certainty and incomparably less apprehension than she had ever done before. She does not lessen, indeed, she rather increases her admonitions to her students to be on their guard. But she is more and more insistent on the position that evil is powerless in the presence of good, and that the only way to see evil is to see it for what it is proclaimed to be in her teaching, nothingness. In other words, an illusion. The ship of science is again mounting the waves, rising above the billows, bidding defiance to the floodgates of error, for God is at the helm. So she writes to one of her students after she had been back in Boston some few weeks, and her confident assurance was, if anything, an understatement. No one could study with any care the record of these months without being struck with the sudden burgeoning forth to be seen on all hands. It is like nothing so much as the coming of an eastern spring after a specially rigorous winter. Whereas before, students had come to Mrs. Eddy for teaching in ones and twos, now they came so many at a time that the little classroom at the college was taxed to capacity. The elder students, moreover, were now better able to stand by themselves and even to take a hand in helping those less experienced. The outstanding event of these days was the founding of the Journal of Christian Science, afterwards called the Christian Science Journal. The first issue appeared on April 14, 1883, with Arthur Buswell as associate editor. It was at first a little 8-page paper issued every other month, and in the opening editorial of the first issue, Mrs. Eddy set forth her objective. "The purpose of our paper," she writes, "is the desire of our heart, namely, to bring to many a household hearth health, happiness, and increased power to be good and to do good." It was an unpretentious little paper, and its difficulties, financial and otherwise, in its early stages were many. But it provided Mrs. Eddy with a much wider platform than had hitherto been available, and one she was able to use to the uttermost. For, in spite of certain peculiarities of style, and the influence of a labored age in writing, from which she found it difficult to shake free, Mrs. Eddy was one of the most effective occasional writers of her day. She had a quite remarkable vocabulary. By actual count, it was much larger than that of her most distinguished contemporaries. In all her life, with a freedom often irritating to the purist, she fitted language to her ideas rather than her ideas to language. Like Emily Dickinson or Walt Whitman, she coined words and misused grammar without compunction or apology. Most of her articles in these early issues of the journals were afterward reprinted in her book, Miscellaneous Writings, and are among the most effective of her lesser writings. A great difficulty about this time was the growing tendency to plagiarize her works. And early in 1883, she determined, possibly fulfilling Gilbert Eddy's wishes, to bring suit against Ahrens and stop the circulation of his pamphlet, most of which, as has already been noted, was simply a transcript from Science and Health. The case came up in the Circuit Court at Boston a few days after the publication of the first issue of the journal. And in view of what was to follow in the same connection within a few years, Ahrens' defense was significant. Ahrens contended, through his counsel, that he could not have infringed Mrs. Eddy's copyright, because Mrs. Eddy's book, Science and Health, was not original with her, but had been largely copied from the works of Phineas P. Quimby of Portland, Maine. When proof of this contention was in due course demanded, Ahrens could produce none. George Quimby of Belfast, Maine, who had his father's manuscripts in his possession, refused to submit them for inspection, and Ahrens had no proof to offer. The case was accordingly quashed, and the court issued a perpetual injunction against Ahrens, restraining him from printing, selling, giving away, or distributing in any manner his pamphlet, under pain of a fine of $10,000. It was further decreed by the court that the remaining copies of the pamphlet, to the number of 3,800, should be put under the knife and their unlawful existence destroyed. The costs of the suit, $113, were taxed against Ahrens. When the Quimby manuscripts were finally published, as they were some 40 years later, it was found that there was no ground for Ahrens' contention. But the subject was to come up again several times before it was finally laid to rest. The immediate effect of the suit was to safeguard more certainly the contents of the journal. As will be clear enough later, these vigorous measures by Mrs. Eddy were not motivated entirely, nor even principally, by a desire to prevent her legal rights being infringed, but to preserve the purity and integrity of her teaching as she understood it. As Christian Science gained in popularity and publicity, first one and then another student, dissatisfied with his position or prospects or the teaching he was given, would go off and found a sect of his own, teaching and preaching his own version of Mrs. Eddy's teaching, calling it Christian Science, and contending for it that it represented an advance on what Mrs. Eddy taught, or a correction of her errors. A succession of highly placed students did just this, and in less than 2 years from the RN's suit, quite a number of Christian Science circles had sprung up, the teachings of which had little or no relation with that set down in Science and Health. But while the journal, to an increasing extent, carried the word of Christian Science, now here, now there, all over the world, the Great Forward Movement, as far as Boston was concerned, was promoted by the Sunday services in Hawthorne Hall. These were becoming increasingly popular. The fact that the meetings were held on Sunday afternoon instead of at the time of the regular church services on Sunday morning or evening enabled many people to attend who would not have done so if it had involved being absent from their own church. The order of service was much the same as it had been in the Baptist Tabernacle on Shawmut Avenue. A hymn, silent prayer, followed by the Lord's Prayer, then short readings from the Bible and Science and Health, another hymn, and finally the sermon. But the character of a meeting was preserved by the fact that questions were allowed and even invited. At first, Mrs. Eddy spoke every Sunday, but later she sometimes delegated one of her students to take her place, and not infrequently invited a minister of one of the other denominations who had in any way shown himself sympathetic towards her teaching, to occupy the pulpit. She generally let it be known when she was going to preach, but when she found, as she did, that when she was scheduled to speak, the hall was often crowded to overflowing, and when she was not so scheduled, the attendance was much less, she adopted the plan of purposely leaving it uncertain until the last moment who was going to occupy the pulpit. As a result, the attendance became more uniform, and meanwhile, she had inaugurated a policy which she was to adhere to invariably in the future, that of discouraging dependence upon herself. She would often arrange with a student to give the address, and then change her mind at the last moment and speak after all. Mrs. Eddy presented a striking figure on the platform. Always well-dressed, she carried herself well and had about her an air of distinction and command, which seemed to compel attention even before she began to speak. She had, moreover, she had it all her life, a knack of wearing her clothes so as to make them appear much better and more costly than they were. Mary Harris Curtis, one of her students, in her recollections, recalls an incident at one of the Hawthorne Hall meetings which illustrates the point. When it came to question time, a woman in the audience asked Mrs. Eddy if she thought it was Christian to wear purple velvet and diamonds, alluding to her costume, to which Mrs. Eddy, after a moment's hesitation, replied, "There are ladies here, I presume, with much more expensive dresses on, as this is velveteen, 36 inches wide and $1 a yard. The cross and ring were given me by those who have been healed in Christian Science with the request that I wear them. It would perhaps be hard to imagine a more effective reply. But as the meetings in Hawthorne Hall grew in popularity, and tales of healing began to be noised abroad with increasing frequency, the ministers of more orthodox faiths were roused to action, some of them to sympathetic investigation, but most of them to vigorous opposition and denunciation. Indeed, Boston in 1883 seems to have set the pace and quality for all future denunciations. There was about it all a venom and a smoldering fury, which was at times reminiscent of nothing so much as the days of Salem witch-baiting. The two great protagonists of Orthodoxy were the Reverend L.T. Townsend, D.D., member of the faculty of Boston University, and the Reverend Stacy Fowler, editor of the Homiletic Review. Dr. Townsend came out straight from the shoulder on one occasion, the Boston Methodist Preachers' Meeting, when his topic was prayer and healing. Alluding to Mrs. Eddy as this woman, he denounced her in so many words as a fraud and a charlatan, declared that her teaching was a crude attempt to resuscitate the defunct idealism of the nihilistic type which appeared in the Middle Ages, and that her views upon all metaphysical matters, we speak very mildly, are a self-contradicting hodgepodge. When the meeting was over, some of the clergymen present urged Dr. Townsend to publish his address. This he subsequently did under the title of The Boston Craze. With a rather engaging inconsistency, Dr. Townsend, at the close of his pamphlet, has this to say: "But notwithstanding these criticisms upon this misnamed Christian Science, fairness requires us to add that this woman, Mrs. Eddy, by her methods, is successful in healing disease. Our professional faith workers are therefore in danger of losing their laurels at the hands of one whom they must regard as an infidel." In other words, it is the old cry, "Give God the glory. As to this man, we know he is a sinner." The Reverend Stacy Fowler took another line. He is quite confident that the movement is already past the peak of its prosperity, and that nothing awaits Mrs. Eddy and her teaching in the future but steady decline and final extinction. Writing in the Homiletic Review for August 1883, Fowler says, confidently enough, "While healers are multiplying, it is evident that the science is waning. Mrs. Eddy writes that her ability to teach the art of healing in her classes in 12 lessons is a greater wonder than her power of instantaneous healing. She may teach the principles of the science in 12 lessons, but she cannot impart her power, her personalism, in 12 nor in 1,200 lessons. The real ictus is her personalism. Her pupils are but feeble imitators of their teacher. Hence, the spell is losing its charm. The movement is losing its momentum. In its present form, it is an epidemic, and as an epidemic, it will pass away, as did the blue glass mania. It is as transcendental as was Brook Farm, and like that experiment, it may be useful in demonstrating that sentiment. Fancy and fitful impulse are not the solid facts of science, nor the panacea for human ills. Dr. Fowler can hardly have had more than a few weeks wherein he could have been accounted a true prophet, for it must quickly have become evident that the movement, far from losing momentum, as he confidently declared, was gaining momentum at a quite bewildering rate. Christian Science and the amazing way in which it was spreading became good copy for the newspapers. There is nothing that an editor likes better than a good controversy, provided that it can be kept within bounds and the newspaper itself not be involved. And Christian Science, wherever it appeared in any community, inevitably aroused controversy. Editors, it is true, often had a hard time, especially in small towns. A neutral attitude on their part was all too often construed by their orthodox readers as one of affording help and comfort to the enemy. Later on, Mrs. Eddy herself entered the lists with vigor, and scarcely a Sunday passed at Hawthorne Hall without her replying to some newspaper or pulpit criticism, if not responding to disapproval voiced from the floor. Some of the issues raised were a little awkward, to say the least, but she parried them all successfully. More than once, for instance, someone would stand to ask, in accusing tones, why this exponent of mind over matter occasionally wore spectacles during her platform appearances. She made short shrift of such inquiries, for in presenting her doctrine as a practical idealism, she disclaimed any inconsistency in doing such things as seem needful until the student reaches the point in demonstrable understanding where such things no longer seem needful. In these early days of advance, her energies were taxed to the uttermost to keep in touch with a movement which was rapidly outgrowing all bounds. By the spring of 1884, it was so well established in Chicago that urgent calls were coming to Mrs. Eddy to go out there and teach a class. A journey from Boston to Chicago was much more of an undertaking then than it is today, and Mrs. Eddy was thronged with work. The journal, the editing of which really devolved upon her, was gaining rapidly in circulation and brought inquiries from many quarters. Every day added to her mail. She was, moreover, teaching regularly in her college, lecturing every Thursday evening, as well as preaching most Sundays at Hawthorne. In the circumstances, Mrs. Eddy felt she could not leave Boston for Chicago. It would mean a full month's absence, and it seemed as though there was no one quite fitted to be left in charge. They were all still pitifully dependent upon her for guidance. she finally decided to ask Clara Choate to go to Chicago in her stead. Mrs. Choate had held the fort faithfully and successfully during the difficult period when Mrs. Eddy was in Washington. She had not infrequently taken her place on the platform at Hawthorne Hall, and she was one of her oldest students. But when Mrs. Eddy broached the question to Clara Choate, she found herself suddenly faced with a situation which, until she had finally written it down, was to face her frequently in the future. Mrs. Choate was doing very well in Boston. She had a large practice, and moving, as she did, in a good social circle, she enjoyed a special distinction from her close association with a woman who was rapidly becoming one of the best discussed people in the country. Chicago was, in those days, to the average Bostonian, very much the West, and Mrs. Choate all too evidently feared that, if she went to Chicago, the more successful she was, the greater likelihood would there be of her having to remain there. This did not appeal to her at all, and so she declined. Mrs. Eddy seems to have realized that, with the movement growing as it was, many opportunities would be lost if her students were not ready to make sacrifices and go without question where opportunity offered. Years afterwards, she was wont to maintain that Christian Scientists should be minutemen and women, and it would seem to have been the reluctance of Clara Choate to go to Chicago at her request that first aroused her to an exaction of instant willing service from her followers, such as was later to become characteristic of the movement as a whole. The immediate step she took in the matter was one that afterwards occasioned her much trouble. Realizing the importance of the problem before her from the point of view of the movement as a whole, she gathered together all the students actually resident in her house and laid the issue before them, requesting them, as she did not wish any thought of dissension to get abroad, to regard the meeting as private. It was a mistake she never would have made in later years. The rock upon which the little church in Lynn had broken up, jealousy, was still a menace. Those who had been summoned to the meeting, some of them at any rate, could not resist the kudos such a summons would surely give them among their fellows. They took care to let the fact of the meeting be known, and then surrounded its proceedings with the utmost secrecy. It was alluded to, mysteriously, as the PM Society, and quickly became a burning question of debate, not only with the students in Boston, but further afield. It met only twice, but so widespread and lasting was the discussion it occasioned that 4 years later, Mrs. Eddy, in reply to charges that the proceedings at these meetings were terrible and too shocking to relate, felt obliged to explain their nature through the journal. After declaring that the society met only twice, she continues, "The first subject given out for consideration was this: there is no animal magnetism. There was no advice given, no mental work, and there were no transactions at those meetings which I would hesitate to have known. The second PM convened in about 1 week from the first. The subject given out at that meeting was, in substance, God is all, there is none beside Him. This proved to be our last meeting. But the stir was sufficient to alienate Clara Choate. There was, as so often happens, no definite breach at first, but the two drifted further apart until, some 3 years later, her name was formally dropped from the roll of the Christian Scientist Association and Church. Meanwhile, Mrs. Eddy determined to go to Chicago herself. She handed over the management of the journal to one of the students, a Mrs. Emma Hopkins, suspended her classes at the college and her Thursday evening lectures, and accompanied by Calvin Fry as secretary and a Mrs. Sarah Cross as companion, set out for Chicago to teach a class of 33, made up of 11 men and 22 women, according to the official history of First Church Chicago. During her stay, she gave a lecture to some 400 people. "Whom do men say that I am?" at Hershey Hall. That was in April 1884. She spent a month there, and could have spent much longer if she had taken everyone who wanted to enroll in her classes. Would-be students came not only from all over Chicago, but from much further afield. While shortly after her return to Boston, applications began to be received from as far west as California. In the issue of the journal for September 1886 appears the name of one Ella Bradshaw, CSD, who, in accordance with the practice at that time, had opened the California Metaphysical College in San Jose, announcing that it afforded an opportunity on the Pacific coast for receiving a course of instruction in the rudiments of Christian Science.